This podcast is a production of Bridges Church. Please visit us at www.bridgeschurch.net.
Today we're going to be in Deuteronomy 6. If you want to turn to your Bible, pull up your phone, you can do that. I think there's also a QR code on the screen behind us. You can get their church app if you don't have it already. You can pull up our sermon notes. Inside of those sermon notes, you'll see two questions. And I'll go ahead and warn you, we're not going to answer those questions very explicitly today. We're not going to have a clean fill-in-the-blank. We're not going to have a really catchy phrase or sentence to answer the questions. But I'm just going to guide our conversation today, and I hope that after the end of this today, you'll have a good understanding. We'll be able to answer those questions together, what they are. The first question and then the sermon notes is just, what's the significance of the Old Testament law today? And then what does that mean for us is the second one. So here we go. First off, a little background on Deuteronomy 6 and Deuteronomy in general. Moses wrote the book of Deuteronomy. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They're commonly referred to as the Pentateuch, which just means five books. They're also referred to as the law. So the law is what we're talking about today, the Old Testament law a little bit. And we're going to talk about what that means here in a second. But essentially, Moses was born, and I'm going to argue, and I'm going to make the case today, that Moses was the most interesting man in the Bible. My wife, Jill, she disagrees with me. She says it has to be Jesus. I told her, why does it have to be Jesus? I'll let you guys decide today. I'll ask you after service when we leave who the most interesting man in the Bible is. Moses was born Hebrew. Moses was born Hebrew in a time when Hebrews were enslaved by the Egyptians. And when Moses was born, he was actually supposed to be killed because of a decree from the Pharaoh. So, but Moses' mother thought he was special, and I imagine most mothers feel that way. But Moses' mother was one of the more, it was right. She saved him. She didn't kill him. She hid him away for 3 months, put him in a basket when he was about 3 months old because she couldn't hide him anymore, couldn't keep him quiet anymore. Put him in a basket, but had his older sister spy on him, basically, to make sure that he was okay, figure out what happened to him. And the princess, the Pharaoh's daughter, ends up finding Moses in the Nile, right? And Moses was raised by her. He was raised Egyptian royalty. He's a Hebrew, born a Hebrew slave, raised in Egyptian royalty. When he was about 18, he knew he was Hebrew, and he went out sort of on an adventure to try to figure out more about his people, his background. And he ends up seeing a Hebrew man beaten up by an Egyptian. And he ends up killing the Egyptian. He looks around, sees no one's there. He gets so upset at what he saw that he killed the Egyptian. He runs away because he's afraid that people are going to find out what he did. And he ends up being a shepherd in the desert. And in the desert, God comes to him in a burning bush that doesn't burn. We don't have time to dive into that story. But just to say that in this moment is when God shows Moses and says, I'm going to have you go and tell Pharaoh to let your people go. All right? Moses says, no, why me? He's hesitant at first, to say the least. But he ends up saying, okay, fine, God, I'll go and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. So Moses goes, tells Pharaoh, hey, you need to let my people go. And Pharaoh responds, as I think Moses had to expect. He said, no, why would I let your people go just because you asked me to? So Moses goes back to Pharaoh and says, hey, I need you to let my people go. But this time Moses had a threat, basically, of the plagues, right? And nine plagues later, he continues to go after plague after plague after plague, and Pharaoh says no, until the 10th one. And the 10th one hit pretty hard. The 10th one, the firstborn son of every Egyptian family was killed one night. Moses goes and tells Pharaoh, how about now? Pharaoh says, sure, I'll let your people go. So they leave, they run away. It didn't take Pharaoh very long to change his mind, and he sends his army after them to bring them back into slavery, right? So a little bit of context here. There were 600,000 Hebrew men, all right? So we think there are about 2 million Hebrews that Moses was leading out of Egyptian slavery, okay? The city of Charlotte's population is 2 million. So Moses was basically taking something like the city of Charlotte, who all they knew before was Egyptian slavery, and running away while an organized army chased after them, okay? So that's sort of what's happening. It's kind of tough. Then they run into a problem called the Red Sea, all right? And it is a sea. It's not a pond. It's not a lake. It's a sea, all right? Big body of water. They get to it. Moses is like, what are we going to do? God says, well, raise your staff in the air, and I'll part the sea. And he did. He raised his staff in the air, and they parted the sea. We think they crossed the sea at a spot where it's about 3 miles long, a little over 3 miles long, okay? So 2 million people crossed the sea in a section that was 3 miles long, and we think there was a lot of wind that had to happen to sort of make this work, physics, right? And to get the water to go up in the air. So it took about 4 hours for 2 million people with the wind. And I don't know about you, I wouldn't have been the first person to volunteer to run across the sea, because that would have looked like I was gonna die. Because there's water, I mean, imagine how deep the sea is. The water had to be higher than that, right, to be a wall. I wouldn't have been the volunteering to run out there. So I'm sure Moses had to find that really bold, brave guy to go first. And they went, 2 million people crossed the sea, they get to their side, and relatively speaking, Moses' story kind of calms down from there. But for anybody else, the story continues on. It's a crazy story, right? They get to their side of the sea. God sets up a covenant with Moses. The covenant just basically means a promise with God, right? And part of this promise is the law that we talked about earlier, okay? So there are 613 laws in the Old Testament. Most of them had to do with social or dietary or hygiene type stuff, right? And basically what happened is if you broke the law, if you were Hebrew and you broke the law, you had to offer an animal sacrifice to God because of your sins, because of your shortcomings, right? That was sort of the deal that was in place. But God made this covenant with his people through Moses, right? Moses was the liaison, he was a mediator between God and God's people throughout this whole deal. The Ten Commandments, part of this law, right? God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses to give to the Hebrew people. Kind of a big deal, right? Really big deal that Moses was that guy. And this was the law that was in place for centuries and centuries until Jesus came and died on the cross, right? So this was how the Hebrew people lived, was because of this law, because of this covenant that was established through Moses. It didn't take long for the Israelites to mess up. Moses was on the mountain with God for 40 days, and they got a little impatient. They thought God had moved on. You know, they found someone better to hang out with. Moses must have found that promised land he kept talking about. I don't know what, but they were getting a little impatient and said, what are we going to do? And so they decided, well, we need to worship something. So oddly enough, the ringleader in all of this was Moses' brother Aaron. And Aaron was with Moses for most of what happened. He went to Pharaoh with Moses, and Aaron was the ringleader here and said, let's get some gold together, let's melt it, let's make it into a golden calf, because it's a normal thing to do, and let's worship and bow down this golden calf, right? So they do it, and God says, Moses, you gotta stop this. I don't know what they're doing, they're losing their minds. So Moses goes down, tells them to stop, and the Israelites continue to mess up to the point where God says, you know what? That land that I promised you, the flowing milk and honey, you don't get to go for 40 years. You have to wander around this desert for 40 years. And as you might imagine, probably 30 years later, a ways into this 40 years, the Israelites started saying, Moses, I don't know, like, is this place really worth it? Like, we're wandering around this desert that has no food, no water, nothing, right? Are you sure that this promised land is really all it's made up to be? Are you sure there's really milk and honey flowing in this place? So Moses goes to God and says, hey, we need to throw him a bone. We need to help him out. I'm losing him. What are we going to do? And God says, well, take your staff and strike a rock, and I'll provide water for everyone and all the animals. And by the way, just a little sidebar here, that staff, if it could talk, that would be the staff I'd want to talk to. If that's the staff that he raised up in the air to part the sea and then struck the rock with, that's got some cool stories. I want to talk to that staff, right? If there's ever a staff to talk to, that'd be the one. So Moses goes out, he makes two mistakes. The first mistake he makes is he tells the Israelites, hey, I got this, don't worry about it, I'm gonna take care of it. The second mistake he makes is he goes to the rock, he strikes it once, that's great. But then he strikes it again. And God says, I don't know that you really got the message there clearly. This is me doing this, right? I don't know why you're taking the credit for it. And then it seems like you didn't have faith the first time. You just want to make sure I really was sure that I didn't forget about those people over there, the animals, I don't know. But you thought I had to get a strike again to get more water. I don't know that you really were on the same page as happening here. And this is a pivotal moment for Moses, all right? I want to pause here for a second because this is really important. This is the point where God punishes Moses for what he just did and says you don't get to go to the promised land. You don't get to go in. You don't get to lead your people into the promised land. And this is a big deal because this is what Moses' whole life had been leading up towards, right? If you're Moses, think about it. He was born Hebrew. He was born a slave, raised Egyptian. He was probably the only person that God could have chosen to go to Pharaoh who had any kind of a leg at all to stand on to say, hey, let my people go. And even then, it took him several trips, right? It wasn't like Pharaoh said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I see where you're coming from. It took him several times to do that. And then God worked through Moses, right? God was working through him and said, this law, the covenant, I'm working through you, Moses. You're the one that I chose to do this through. And for decades, Moses had been that person that God worked through to talk to his people, to communicate to his people, to love his people. He'd been that vessel. And so Moses had to be thinking, all this was so I could lead my people to the promised land. It's a big, big deal, right? So then we get to Deuteronomy. And that kind of sets up where he's coming from in this book of Deuteronomy. He's saying, you know, I'm going to have to go in a little bit. This 40 years is about to come up. You're going to get to go to the promised land, but I don't get to go with you. And so I need you to know these few things, right? I need you to know something. I just need to get some of these things out there because you're not going to have me anymore, right? I'm not going to be able to be this mediator, this liaison between God and you. So I need you to know something before I go. And that's what we get to here in the book of Deuteronomy. He starts to lay out in the beginning of the book what God has done and where God has brought them from, right? So he says, you know, we were slaves, right? All we knew was that we were Egyptian slaves. And now look at us. We're on the verge of entering this land that God had promised to us. We're so close. We're there. Just remember what God has done. It's important. Things are going to get tough. It won't always be easy. It's been tough. It hasn't always been easy. But remember what God did for us to get us to this point, right? Don't forget that. And then he starts to lay out why he believes the Israelites should continue to follow the law, the motivation behind the law, right? Now, there's two ways I think you can look at this. You can look at it and say there's 613 laws, and God is basically kind of like a commander in the military saying, fall in line or else you're going to get in trouble, right? Like, these are just laws, maybe somewhat arbitrary, but they're do's and don'ts. Listen to them, obey them. If you don't, you're in trouble, right? Or you could look at them the way Moses did and say, really, the law is here so that you can, I'm sort of guiding you and directing you towards me, right? There's sort of guardrails set up so that you end up finding me and finding my will and all this. It's not because I just want you to have to live a life this way because I think that it's fun to tell you what you can do, what you can't do. It's because I want you to grow closer to me, grow closer to my will. And these are just ways to help you get there. That's kind of what Moses is laying out. And the beautiful thing is that we get a glimpse of what the Israelites, what the psalmist thought of the law in Psalm 119. And it's so cool. There's 176 verses we get to unpack to see that. And we're not going to read them all today because we haven't even gotten to Deuteronomy 6 yet. But we are going to read a few of those verses. Just get an idea of what the Israelites thought about the law, what they had to say about it. Read it for yourself. There's all kinds of cool ways in here where Moses, or the psalmist, is saying, this is what we think about the law, what we think about God's word in general. So we're going to start with Psalm 119, verses 14 through 16. Be on the screen behind me. Verse 14, I have rejoiced in your laws as much as in riches. I will study your commands and reflect on your ways. I will delight in your decrees and not forget your word. Verse 24, your laws please me. They give me wise advice. 47, 48, how I delight in your commands, how I love them. I honor and love your commands. I meditate on your decrees. 59 and 60, I ponder the direction of my life and turn to follow your laws. I will hurry without delay to obey your commands. And finally, verse 105, your word is a lamp to guide my feet and a light to my path. All kinds of cool ways. They are wisdom, right? They bring them joy. They please them. It's wise advice. The law was something that they thought of in a very positive light, right? When I was in school, I did not think of the rules and that I had to follow in school as a delight or rejoice in these rules, right? They looked at them very differently because it was a way for them to connect with, grow closer to God and his will for their life, right? C.S. Lewis wrote about religious practices, which for the Israelites, the law clearly was a religious practice. He wrote about this in a letter from 1953. He said, I wouldn't quite say that religious practices help the search for truth, for that might imply that they have no further use when the truth has been found. I think about the practices, what a wise old man or wise old priest said to me about a rule of life in general. It's not a stair, but a banister or a rail. It's not the thing you ascend by, but it's a protective against falling off and a help up. I think thus we ascend. The stair is God's grace. One's climb from step to step is obedience. Many different kinds of banisters exist, all legitimate. It is possible to get up without any banisters, if you need to, but no one would willingly build a staircase without them because it would be less safe, more laborious, and a little lacking in beauty. I think C.S. Lewis got to the point of what, the heart of what Moses was saying there. He's saying that the law isn't this rigid thing, do this or do that. It's a help, right? It's that banister that protects us, that helps us up. It's not the most important thing, but it is a thing, right, that we need to do to help get closer to God. He set this up in place for a reason and on purpose. So after reminding them of the law, Moses starts out in Deuteronomy 6 by saying this, these are the commands, decrees, and regulations that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you. You must obey them in the land you're about to enter and occupy, and you and your children and grandchildren must fear the Lord your God as long as you live. If you obey all of his decrees and commands, then you will enjoy a long life. Listen closely, Israel, and be careful to obey. Then all will go well with you, and you will have many children in the land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. So love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength. That was so good that Jesus quoted them centuries later. The Sadducees had asked Jesus a question. They said, what is heaven going to be like? And Jesus said, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't change what happens in your life today. It doesn't change what happens in your life tomorrow. And the Pharisees thought that was so amusing that they thought it would be a good idea to try to trick Jesus. And they asked him, hey, Jesus, what's the most important command in the law of Moses? And Jesus answers them in Matthew 22, verses 37 through 40. He said, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. Get this last part here. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commands. There's a lot to unpack there. First, remember that Jesus was born in a time, and at this point, currently living in a time when the law of Moses, this first covenant that God made with Moses, was what people lived under, right? And he's saying you can sum up all of the law of Moses in these two things. If you love God with all you've got, and if you love one another as you love your neighbor, then naturally, you'll be following the law, right? You don't have to worry about knowing all this, because if you're doing those two things, you focus on those two things, you're going to be all right, and it's going to make sense. And that kind of answers the first question that I told you we're going to answer today, right? What's the significance of the law today? We're no longer under that old covenant, but Jesus said if we're doing that, and these we call these the greatest commandments, right? And we have so many churches, so many ministries, so many people build their lives and focus on these two things that are so important, right? God said, if you do these two things, you're living a pretty good life. And so if you do that, you're also following the law, right? And so maybe it's not this thing that we have to rigidly follow, right? But if we're loving God with all we got and we're loving each other, then we're going to be okay, and we're going to continue to grow closer and closer to God's will, and we're going to do exactly what, get to the same place that God wanted the Israelites to get to when Moses gave them the law, right? It's easy to write off the law as part of the old covenant that doesn't apply anymore. It's old-fashioned. It's out of date. But it's also too narrow-minded, I think, to say that it has everything to do with what we do today, right? Like, we have to rigidly follow it. We have to live it out in the strictest sense possible, because if that were true, we would have all offered far too few animal sacrifices this year, last year, and the year before, right? Like, that's not the way it's supposed to work. And that would be discrediting a lot of what Jesus did on the cross. Right, Jesus came to die on the cross for us so we didn't live under this anymore. It would discount what the role the Holy Spirit plays in our lives today if this was some rigid thing that we follow to the strictest sense. I said this before, but I had a professor in college. She was my Old Testament professor, and she said, the Bible is a story of God bringing his people back to him. The Bible is a story of God bringing his people back to him. Moses was a part of that story. The law was a part of that story. Jesus was a really big part of that story. And even today, you and I are a continuation of that story, right? We're a continuation of the story of God bringing his people back to him. We're all part of the same story. We came in at this story at different times. Different things apply in different ways. But we're all part of the same story. And at the end of the day, we're all being brought back to God because of what he's doing in our lives, right? It all connects. It's all a little different. Deuteronomy 6, we're gonna go back a couple of verses here and then read through the end of our passage for today. He says this, "Listen, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone, and you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and you must commit yourselves wholeheartedly to these commands that I'm giving you today. Repeat them again and again to your children. Talk about them when you're at home and when you're on the road and when you're going to bed and when you're getting up. Tie them to your hands, wear them, tie them to your forehead. Reminders, write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates." Now, as a family minister here at Bridges, I want to camp out here for a little bit, if that's all right. He's talking to the entire nation of Israel, and he's saying, remind children of these commands that I've given you. Repeat them every day when they wake up, when you're eating, when you're traveling, when you go to bed at night, throughout your day-to-day life. Build this into it. Build these rhythms into your life, right? He isn't saying parents do this. He isn't saying teachers do this. He isn't saying children's ministers do this. He's saying everyone, all over 2 million people, do this. This is important. This is a responsibility that you have to continue on what God has done in our lives, to continue these, to pass on these truths and these principles to this generation so that they can pass it on to the next generation and the generation after that and the generation after that. And notice he's not saying pass on these traditions, right? He's saying pass on these truths and principles, what Jesus summed up as loving God with all you got and loving each other as your neighbor. Loving your neighbor as yourself, right? If you pass those two things on, then we're doing a good job, right? This is sort of what he's saying. It's our responsibility collectively, not as just parents, not as just teachers, not as just children's ministers, but as a collective nation, this was their responsibility. That leads us to the answer to that second question from earlier. Now that we know what the role of the Old Testament is, the Old Testament law is, what do we do about it? And the simple answer here that isn't wrong, but I think should be elaborated on, is to love God with all you've got and love each other as well, right? If we can do those two things, then yeah, you got it, kind of. But I think there's something more, right? I think we can do more with that. I think the responsibility God's given us is to do more with that. And what is that more? I think it's to invest in the next generation, to make sure that we're showing them, exemplifying to them what it looks like to love God with all that we've got and to love others as well. If we can do that and we can show them, then I think it's doing what Moses told the Israelites to do here, right? Every child deserves to have an adult in their corner who's fighting for them, who's cheering for them, who's encouraging them, who's loving them, and who's showing them what it looks like to love God with all you got and to love others. Most of the time, that adult is a parent, right? Parents know their kid better than anyone else ever could. Parents spend more time with their kid than anybody else ever could. Sometimes that person's a grandparent, and sometimes that person has to be somebody else, because we all know, and I think we're all aware of the fact that not every parent has willfully taken on that role in their kid's life, right? Jill and I have a friend named Lauren. I met Lauren when I was in college. I did an internship in Eastern Kentucky, and Lauren was leaving eighth grade. I went to her eighth grade graduation that May. So this was the summer between her eighth grade year and her ninth grade year. And Lauren had kind of a rough life. Her dad had been in and out of jail when she was young for some different reasons and wasn't really a part of her life at all anymore. I don't know when the last time she had seen him was. Her mom just sort of up and left right there at the end of her eighth grade year, right before I met her. She ran off to Ohio with some guy and left Lauren and her brothers with her stepdad. Her stepdad lost her job, and social services came and took the kids away from him. And I don't know all the details and what happened. It doesn't seem like this should have been the way it worked, but basically Lauren lived with us that summer because she had built a really good relationship with CJ, our director. And so Lauren hung out with us the entire summer, and she was essentially homeless. I don't really know who was her guardian at that point in time. So she got to hang out with us all summer. And like I said, CJ and her were really close, but CJ had just had a baby. So she was still living in Louisville, about 3 hours away. And that summer, I remember at least two big meetings where CJ drove in to where we were and met with a social worker and a couple people from the area who were potentially going to take Lauren in and adopt her or at least be her guardian. And I don't know all the ins and outs. I think at one point CJ may have wanted Lauren to live with her, but Lauren had lived in Eastern Kentucky her entire life. Lauren's friends were there. Her school was there. So that really wasn't the best solution, and CJ knew that. But CJ and Lauren had gotten such a close relationship where CJ was that champion that Lauren deserved in her life. She was the one who fought for her. Even when her mom was still there, I think a lot of times Lauren would tell you, CJ was really the one who was fighting for her. CJ was the one who was definitely investing in her spiritually. And CJ fought for her that summer. She had just had a baby, drove in a few times just to make sure Lauren was in the right situation. And Jill and I were really close with Lauren. Lauren was in she was a bridesmaid at our wedding. But I got a phone call from Lauren this week, and I didn't think I was going to do this. She asked me to officiate a wedding, and I get to stand up there on the stage beside CJ, while CJ tells everyone in the room, her future husband, her closest friends and closest family, CJ gets to tell everyone in that room why Lauren was worth it. Just to remind them all why this kid who was abandoned and left by people who are supposed to love her a lot, why she was worth it, why she matters. And I get to stand there and listen to that. And I'm really excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm so excited for Lauren and for Skylar. And I know that day is more important than the story CJ is going to tell. But I'm really excited to stand there and get to stand beside CJ while she tells that story. And make sure everyone in the room knows why Lauren was worth it. We don't all get to be CJs in someone's story. But if you do, I hope you fight for that kid as hard as you can. Hope you don't give up. They're going to fight. They're going to push. Lauren will be the first one to tell you, her and CJ did not get along all the time. There were times when CJ knew it was best for Lauren, but Lauren didn't know it yet. But fight for that kid, because that kid is worth it. That kid matters. And I don't know if there's anything you can do to impact the next generation in a more significant way than being that person in that kid's life. Because that kid needs it so much. That kid needs a champion. That kid needs someone who has that adult in their life who matters. To think that they matter to some adult in their life. We all can't be the CJ, but I'll tell you what we all can do. We can all come alongside and partner with parents, partner with grandparents who have stepped in their role, partner with champions who have stepped in their role for a kid. As a parent, I can tell you sometimes we need someone to talk to, right? Sometimes things aren't going the way we wanted. We just need to get things out there in the open. Sometimes we need someone to remind us how important it is that we invest in our kids spiritually. And a lot of the times, we need someone to pour into us just so we have something to pour back into our kids. And I'll tell you, you don't have to have been a parent to invest relationally in a parent. You don't have to be a therapist to let a parent tell you how bad their week was or what's going on in their life or what's tough right now for them, what's not working the way they're supposed to be. And although we need more volunteers in family ministry on Sunday morning, I'll tell you, you're going to have more of an impact in the next generation if in the next year you take two dads or you take two moms and you start a D group with them than if you show up in preschool for me a couple times a month. Because you're investing in the person that has the most influence in that kid's life. And that kid will probably never connect the dots. That kid will probably never realize that because you started a D group with their mom or their dad, that impacted them in some significant way. But that's okay. Make that person, make that parent, make that champion, make them the hero in their story. Give them some relational capital that they may not have in that moment. So when they need it, they have somewhere to go to, right? They don't need to know that it was because of you, but make that person the hero. Why not? Now, we do need people to volunteer over in the family ministries. I'm not going to tell you that's not true, because we do. And what we really need, to be completely honest with you, is someone who will show up every single week in a kid's life so they know there's an adult at church who loves them, who cares about them, and who wants them to know who Jesus is, and shows them every single week what it looks like to love God with all they've got and love others. We need that. We do. It can't just be that one person, right? Lauren needed other people besides CJ. Kids need more than just their mom and dad, right? They need other adults in their lives to show them that. That's the responsibility that we have collectively, right? So why say that that's more important? It's more important to be that person in that parent's life because of that influence they have, right? Yeah, we need people over there. You know what else we need? Shamelessly, I will say, we need help at VBS this summer, July 12th through 15th. If you want to help decorate, help set up, tear down, whatever you need to do, we need help. Then you can take a picture of that or come talk to me. We need help at VBS. We need help over there on Sunday mornings. I would love to talk to you. I would love to talk to you and point you in the right direction. If you want to start a D group with parents, let me know. Come talk to me, and I'll talk to some parents. I'll get you connected with somebody you can invest in this year. And we need help with VBS, too. I don't know if I took the screen down or not, but we need help with VBS again, too. All right? Deuteronomy 6, Moses tells Israel they have the responsibility of influencing the next generation. That can seem like it's got some of a negative connotation to it, right? Like a responsibility could be an obligation. I don't like to do all the things I'm responsible for all the time. So let's look at it as an opportunity. We have an amazing, an awesome opportunity to invest in the next generation, to pour into them, to be the church, just like the Israelites were for the next generation in Moses' day. It's an awesome opportunity. It's a fantastic opportunity that we have to do that. And I hope that we can take that somehow, some way. If you're a champion for a kid, if you're a parent, you're a grandparent who's investing in that kid, just know something, that we're praying for you. We love you. We want to support you in any way that we possibly can. That's what we're here for, to church, to love on you and support you. Let us know if there's anything we can do to help you in that way. Thank you, guys. We're going to pray. And Luke's going to come up here and do communion, and then we're going to sing one more song at the end. All right? God, we love you so much. God, we just thank you for the story, for Moses' story, for the example that he set for the Israelites, for the example that we see throughout the Bible, what it looks like for adults and for us to love God with all of God and to love others. And God, I just pray that we can be that example, we can be that influence that the next generation needs to do that very thing. God, I pray for all the parents in the room and online who are listening. I pray that you give them what they need today to be the best parent they can be, to invest in their kid, to be the champion that they need and deserve so badly. God, we love you so much. In your name, we pray.